number two, open public input. We do have a number of people on a variety of topics, which is great. Many of you have done this before. It's a three-minute time, and that is enforced because we have a lot of people, and I know some people would like to go for 3 days, but we have 3 minutes. You'll hear a buzzer go off, and that's audible, right? When the buzzer goes off, your 3 minutes are up. Bring your thoughts to a conclusion if you haven't, and then we'll move on. I will call you up two at a time, so just take two seats, and then we'll just keep rotating that. So the first two, and I apologize ahead of time. If everybody was named Smith, I would get your names all right, but thanks to our immigrant tradition, I'm not fluent in too many other languages here. So James Lauren and David Lynn, please. So, James, you get to kick off the morning.
Good morning. I'm here to comment on the department's policy of lethal wolf predation amelioration. I am James Loran, a resident of Collin County, Washington, identifying with Port Angeles as my hometown. I, like many others on the Olympic Peninsula, look forward to wolves returning to our region on their own 4 feet. The reestablishment of wolves in areas that have historically been a native species is a proven catalyst for the improvement of the environment, strengthening species. There is solid science about the reintroduction of the wolf, and I cite two examples here. The science paper entitled Natural Recolonization and Admixture of Wolves in the U.S. Pacific Northwest, Challenges for the Protection and Management of Rare and Endangered Taxa by Sarah A. Hendricks et al., 2018, analyzes the genetics of the Canis lupus wolf common to the northern Rocky Mountains and the coastal rainforest of the Pacific Northwest, U.S. and Canada, and establishes the extant distribution and genetic relevance for protection under federal and state endangered species protection. It clearly states in its summary the need for the continued support of the wolf's redistribution. I quote in part from that summary, "Efforts to enhance the density and distribution of coastal wolves in the Pacific Northwest should be considered a hedge against population decline in coastal Alaskan or South Coast BC wolves. This effort will aid in the preservation of adaptations for the coastal environment and decrease the likelihood of hybridization with coyotes. To preserve this southern genetic refugium for coastal BC wolves, restore ecological processes, and permit contemporary evolution, natural expansion, and protection of the coastal wolves in the contiguous U.S. should be an emphasis of wolf management in the Pacific Northwest." End of quote. I also refer to the science paper entitled The Effects of Breeder Loss of Wolves by Scott M. Brainerd et al., 2008. This paper deals with the effects of wolf pack separations due to removal by lethal and non-lethal means. I quote in part from its summation in the section entitled Management Implications. "We recommend that managers carefully evaluate the possible effects of lethal control on territorial wolves relative to ethical and biological considerations." End of quote. In response to the department's adopted plan of lethal removal of wolves in northeastern Washington, it is my opinion that science, experience, and common sense clearly suggest that cattle and wolves cannot mix in this type of terrain. Wolves are here to stay. Cattle should not be grazed on steep, heavily forested terrain on public lands. It is inhumane to the cattle and inhumane to the wolves who are killed as a result. Thank you.
Thank you, James.
Yeah.
Bradley?
Really? Yes, sir.
I just need to speak to that really quickly.
Not all cattle are grazed on public ground. There is a lot of private ground in my part of the world. So I just wanted to make that point, that not all cattle are grazed on public ground.
Thank you. Excuse me, one more.
Could you just quickly repeat the title of that, the first study that you mentioned?
Certainly.
natural recolonization and admixture of wolves in the U.S. Pacific Northwest, challenges for the protection and management of rare and endangered taxa.
Natalie Drake, please, and David.
Director and Commissioners, my name is David Lynn, and I'm here from Ocean Shores representing myself, but I also speak for the concerns of a good number of my friends and neighbors. On August 20th, Director Suswind ordered the killing of the Togopak male. After a brief delay, he was shot and killed from a helicopter gunship on September 2nd. He leaves behind at least two pups and their mother. The Togopak was accused of six depredations. Curiously, for the first two depredations observed last November, there was no Togopak. But when it was identified this year, the department retroactively and arbitrarily assigned the blame to this newly formed pack. On May 20th of this year, a calf was reported killed on U.S. Forest Service land. It was about a week and a half old. That's right, a week and a half, not a month and a half or 4.5 months, but a week and a half old. Protocol requires the calves be much older and larger so that they are not such easy targets for predators. The investigator determined that it was a wolf kill, but there was no scavenging in the carcass other than by birds. An investigation on August 8th notes that a deceased cow was in a deep and steep ravine. The investigator stated, hemorrhaging was present, but no bite marks or other external injuries were present. I believe the hemorrhaging I observed was from the cow falling down or tumbling down a steep creek ravine and striking rocks or trees in the process. A department press release stated that due to rugged terrain, the carcass was left on site. If this site were so treacherous, why would anyone think it's safe to graze cattle there? An injured calf was reported on August 9th. The attack was attributed to wolves, but the nearest reported GPS position of the collared male was 2 miles away. An injured calf was discovered on August 18th. An investigator noted the injured calf was discovered with a group of cattle miles from where they were supposed to be on the allotment. Obviously, this rancher was not protecting his herd, yet he's held blameless. So what we really have is perhaps one depredation that can be attributed to the Togopak, with the others being attributed to human carelessness and revised history. Note that all the depredations that occurred in 2018 were on U.S. Forest Service land. That is on our public land. This is our wildlife on our public land being killed on behalf of private commercial interests. Where is our voice? These commercial interests get reimbursed by the state for the value of their losses, so they suffer no financial consequences, while we suffer the loss of our precious and endangered wildlife. Director Suswind likely felt he was acting in accordance with a protocol put forth by the Wolf Advisory Group, but we have seen that protocol is badly flawed. The WAG is controlled by ranchers and hunters, and while these two groups comprise about 5% of our state's population, they control a majority of seats on the WAG and dictate the rules. Were the WAG to truly represent the people of Washington, its policies would be much different and more truly reflect the will and conscience of the people of our state. Today, I mourn for the Togopak friend and curse those who killed him. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Kathleen Drake and Natalie, welcome.
Thank you. Chairman, good morning, Chairman Smith and members of the committee. Hi, I am Natalie Drake, and I've been following the wolf's plight for 4 years through personal research, Brenda Peterson, author of Wolf Nation, and Amarok Weiss, a wolf advocate, and I have educated myself on both sides of the issue. I am saddened and outraged by what's happening to this majestic keystone species. I believe that wolves are a key to the environment's survival. The reintroduction at Yellowstone proves this. Without wolves, deer and elk overpopulate and eat every green in sight. I understand we somehow think we can keep deer and elk population under control, but the hunters tend to hunt the strong, healthy deer and elk, while the wolves tend to hunt the injured, sick, or old. The way the hunter's doing it is injuring the herds. We use so much money to hunt and kill the wolves. Isn't there a better solution to this that might even cost less money? Because I don't think we've tried every non-lethal measure there is. If we had, then the wolves wouldn't be dead. In conclusion, I believe that wolves are primed to the earth's survival, and I hope I've convinced you too.
Thank you. You did an outstanding job.
Thank you.
So that's a proud mom?
Yes.
Bob Drake, that's probably...
Proud dad, yes.
Proud mom, it's up to you now.
Most of the family today. Yes.
Sorry, I'm a little emotional after that.
You want to swap places with your husband?
Will that work better?
No. If you wanted to.
No, I was going to go. Oh, no, I'll compose myself. I'm good.
Thank you, Chairman Smith and members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Drake, mother of Natalie Drake, as you gathered. I am proud to say that she gets her passion for wolves because of me. I began to study wolves and really the complex issue of cohabitation with wolves. It is a complex issue. And while I didn't pursue that fervently later in life, I'm sorry, maybe I should have had him go first. I am thrilled, I am awed, and I'm so proud of my daughter who has and is. She and I represent a group of people who believe and understand how intelligent and magnificent the species is, with a really complex social structure that, frankly, we could learn a lot from. What we are up against today is so huge. We're not up against an individual. We're not up against an industry. I feel that we are up against a societal concept, a pervasive mindset that believes that wolves are pests or vermin that need to be eradicated. I don't know if you've heard the term, the only good wolf is a dead wolf, right? I feel that that's what we are up against. There's a large group of people who believe this mindset. And that group sometimes feels much larger and much more powerful than ours. And we strongly oppose anybody who represents that group of people. What's happening in our state today is so wrong. And it feels little different than if we were to begin killing orcas because of the way they affect the salmon industry. Today, the reason I'm here is I want to call for solutions. And I believe that because we don't have the right answers yet simply means we have not asked the right questions. Today, I don't bring answers, but I hope to begin to ask the right questions. Have we as a state exhausted every possible option? To solve this problem of cohabitation without violence or bloodshed, do we truly care about this species? Do we truly care? Or is the term wolf management empty words or just a euphemism for the extermination of wolves? And of course, I don't expect any answers today, but I will know, we will all know, based on the actions that this committee takes from this day forward. Thank you for your time, respectfully.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Brad Caldwell, please. And Bob, you're bringing up the rest of the family.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Smith, members of the commission. With respect, I'm not here to debate the science. I wish Amrock was here to do that today, but she's in court handling this from another angle. I'm here to object to the inhumane killing of wolves. I'm a longtime resident of Washington State. I am asking simply for more time to study this issue before more killing takes place. It's my understanding 19 wolves have been killed. It's my understanding that 15 of them have been associated with a single rancher. That's what my research shows. I don't find this acceptable with an endangered species with numbers slightly above 100. Wolves have a right to live. I would just ask to remain silent in thought for the next 19 seconds for each wolf that has been taken to honor them. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Natalie, keep studying science. Randy, good? And Brad.
Thank you. I'm a retired fish biologist. I had worked for Department of Ecology. And so since I have a fair amount of time now, I fish an awful lot here locally off of Boston Harbor, Zittles, and Lure Beach. And probably 2 to 3 times a week, I've been out there in July, August, and September. And so as a fish biologist, one of the things I noticed is that mostly the Chinook we catch out there are 6 pounds, 11 pounds. They're not particularly big Chinook. We catch probably one every other trip. But that what I noticed is a lot of the fish we're letting go because there's a minimum size of 22 inches. Catch a fair amount of 19 to 21 inches. And by mid-August, these fish are turning dark, which means they're mature jacks that are headed up the river. And so probably as much as half or more of the catch are mature jacks that we're letting go to run back up in the Squally or the Deschutes River. You know, and the purpose of the minimum size is to protect juveniles, but these aren't juveniles. These are adult fish that are headed up to spawn. And so I was suggesting that perhaps we could change the minimum size requirement for Chinook in marine area 13 here from, say, 22 down to maybe even 16 inches, because some of the fish have been 16 that are dark and headed up. And I catch very few juveniles during that time. So because it's a time when the adults are coming back and ready to spawn, I think it's pretty safe to go ahead and lower the minimum size during that July, August, September time. And you can increase the sport catch at no cost. And these are also fish that wouldn't be caught in a net up in the Nisqually either, because they're running about 3.5 pounds. And, oh, one of the things I'd like to give you kudos for is about 14 months ago, your department started posting daily fish counts for Puget Sound. And I have to admit, most mornings at 6 o'clock, that's the first thing I read is what did they catch yesterday. So I really wanted to thank you for the daily posting of fish counts. It really helps a lot. And the other thing is that we get their daily counts for the Columbia River and Westport and such, but they're usually posted after about 2 weeks. So it'd be really nice if they could also be dailies. But and then I also wanted to give a kudo that the fact that you picked Kelly and Joe to be managers, because I worked with them at Department of Ecology and for many years. I've been retired 5 years ago, but they were really excellent managers then, and they are now. So just throwing that out there.
So is the size of adult or pre-spawning fish diminishing down here? Or
yeah. Yeah, you know, most of the time you wouldn't consider an adult Chinook to be 6 to 11 pounds, but that's pretty much the size that we're catching out there.
Is that anything that's being investigated? Do we have an idea of what's going on? Is this an ocean conditions phenomenon? I throw those questions out, not seeing anybody here among, well, Ron maybe, but just curious.
So maybe I can just stand up here instead of.
Yeah, if you can.
So,
Mike, though.
Commissioners, Ron Warren, Fish Program. Thanks for the opportunity to talk. We are receiving a lot of comments relative to this. We are starting to look into if there are practices that we can take to change the size limit or the sizes of returning fish. We have looked into and had negotiations with co-managers relative to fisheries to change the minimum size. What we've found is that the constituency, our citizens of the state of Washington, are split pretty 50-50, that some want to reduce down to 18 inches, some want to stay at 22 inches, and have never been able to move off the 50-50 mark, and we've left it where it has been. So I just wanted to come up and share that with you. We'll continue to ask the questions during our fishery planning process. Hope to see you at those meetings for North Falcon, and more people that participate, the better off we are. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Just a comment, Commissioner Thornburn, when we were at the meeting in Tri-Cities for the Columbia River Policy Review, I posed that question to Chris Kearns with the Oregon staff and asked if there had been studies that could determine the reason that we seem to see diminishing size of our returning Chinook and other species. And he did mention that he thought there was some work being done or had been done, and he just hasn't gotten back to me. There's theories about the reasoning for that, and we can talk about it later.
Janice Schweitzer and Randy.
Randy Good from Cedar Woolley. I submitted written comments, a copy of the proviso and some pictures. I hope you'll take a look at it. Concerning the Skagit Elk Management Update, the update fails to address the proviso's mandate to develop and implement a plan to address agricultural and vehicle damages with funds that are already in the general fund of DFW to get elk off private lands to state and federal lands, as the proviso states. Just a continuation of the failed, unworkable solutions for the past 2 years up in Skagit. DFW's failed actions do not support implementation of that of the 10-year plan. The update mentions co-managers' all-tools approach to the Skagit issue. Elk cause intrusions year-round. There should be no limits on the number of complaints or amount per year a landowner can file for. Grass does not qualify presently for compensation, yet landowners, as shown in the assessor's survey, are having to purchase $11,000 to $34,000 worth of hay each year to replace grass consumed by the elk. Survey estimates $1.4 million in elk intrusions and damages annually. Add to that $400,000 to homeowners' gardens and orchards, plus elk vehicle damages on the highway. Every few days, we see results of elk vehicle accidents, and I got last Tuesday's picture attached. Present compensation process is unfair and not realistic. Please review Bill Smith's letter that he sent attached to my written comments also. Not one word from the co-managers on the failure to control spreading the hoof rot. The specialists have failed to inform you on the failures of the kill permitting process. My farm has averaged 5 to 7 kill permits per year for 5 years. 75% have been failures. Master hunters leave half of the elk and I have to bury it. Muzzle hunters, not one has been successful. They just wound the elk. Other hunters are poor shots and send them away wounded and then cause them more damages. Under the tool, maintain conflict specialist is also unworkable up there. Still no response or record of my 14 complaints I filed. These same elk are now on the blueberry farm that filed the complaint August 8th. 35 days now and counting, over $100,000 in eaten berries and damages to 35 more acres of blueberry plants, not counting. Specialist solution, one elk permit with one bow hunter. A neighboring dairy, $48,000 in damages annually. Filed a complaint, still waiting over 30 days now. No response. So you can see misinformation in the update does not show the disaster that's happening in the field. DFW officials and specialists' position now seems to be to ignore all complaints, has now become a tool to stop complaints, not address the damages being caused by elk intrusions. Thank you.
Thank you. Director, I had the opportunity to visit the area a couple times, and as you'll hear in the next couple of presentations,
I know Amy's been doing a fine job over there, but it is something that I think deserves our focus. So thank you, Randy.
The Farm Bureau put together Safe Family Farm, and the Farm Bureau put together a video, and Kelly has agreed to come up and for a tour. So I really appreciate Kelly. You know, that's what.
Good. Yeah, you'll find it very informative. Maybe get some raspberry jam at one of the places. Thanks, Randy. John and Janice. Good to see you.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. And as I listen, I don't envy any of you because you have to hear all sides. And nobody comes up and says, wow, you're doing a great job. But I just thought, you actually are, because when the elk were introduced into the Skagit Valley in 1900, it failed. And when they came in 45, they failed. And then they were in declining numbers and at a critical level in the 80s. And through your terrific management, we have gotten them up to over 2,100 head. The problem now, as I read the elk management plan, is that, as Randy just said, you walk away with the feeling that this is what we're doing and we're solving the problem, and we're not seeing it here. I know you want to have the facts. So Randy gave you a lot of facts. If you own a farm or a business and the elk are intruding upon your property and you're paying thousands of dollars, this plan doesn't address it. The fencing, the hazing, the master hunters, that's not working. We referred to the farm video, and in that video, you'll see a map where the elk really belong and then where the elk are right now, and that's the problem. So Bill Schmidt would recommend that, number one, that you listen to all the complaints. Don't just dismiss them. See how great the problem is. Get the facts. And then really the only solution is to move the elk. Don't waste any more time trying to see how many there are, and giving kill permits, etc. Just try to move the elk out, because we like the elk, just not in our backyard.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
And Ronald Reed, please. John, good to see you.
Yes. I would like to thank you for the opportunity this morning to attend the committee meeting and being allowed to speak. It was a good experience, and I was able to see what else you guys work with, work around, and everything else. So, okay. So, good morning, and thank you for this opportunity. My name is John Jonasson, and I'm here to discuss once again the Skagit elk issues. I realize you have a full plate with the wolf and whale issues. I am sure much of your time is taken up with these two issues. Our issue is like a pot on the back burner. It has reached a boiling point and is not healthy for anyone. I have turned in packets for your review. Please take the time to read and consider my suggestions. The suggestions would be revenue-producing for the department and would go a long ways to help reduce numbers and issues associated with the Skagit elk. I also want to bring up the language in the proviso. In our opinion, has not been met. Maybe if the department would meet with landowners on a more regular basis, we could have more open dialect. The last meeting with the majority of landowners being present was April 14th. That's 5 months. Openness and honest discussion would benefit all parties involved. Currently, we're starting into the heart of the damage season. Over the next 7 months, it'll only get worse. The number of elk are greater this year than last year, and without a doubt, the damages will be greater as well. The number of damage tags proposed for this year will not be enough to make a difference. A lot of farmers in Eastern Skagit County operate on a shoestring budget, much like DFW, and can't afford to feed the elk or accept the damages. We must work together to resolve this issue, as we can't ask our customers to pay more just because we're not making a profit because of damages from the elk. The rights and family history of the landowners must also be respected. In my case, we're approaching 100 years of owning and operating a farm on the same property. I look forward to working through these issues with the new director and current staff. I will make myself available to assist with any solutions of substance and not just words. Thank you for your time again, and have a great day.
And when the director comes up, you're going to be part of that tour?
Yeah.
Okay.
Brandon.
Yes.
And this is going to be pointed to my fellow commissioners right off the get-go. I've got to know this guy pretty well. We've talked for hours on the phone. And two things with this problem we are blessed with is we've got two people that are very smart, common sense people, with John and with Amy. Amy's done an amazing job on this thing. But
I agree.
Can damn well relate to what John's going through. Last summer, I had a really crappy field of oats, and was trying to make up my mind whether they were going to be worth cutting or not. A bunch of elk moved in for a couple nights. It was a done deal. So I can relate to what he's doing. And I'm just saying, John and these people are trying to make a living. They're not asking for outlandish demands by any shape, matter, or form. And I just am going to speak to this. Don't question this man's integrity or character. If we end up, he's got to do what he's got to do to protect his property. And there again, if this deal goes sideways a little bit, do not question his character integrity. So, thank you.
Thank you.
I spent all day questioning your integrity.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
But you came right back. Thank you. So, Lorna Smith and Ronald.
Good morning. Thank you. Is this on?
Yes.
Is it working?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Ronald Reed. My wife, Debbie, and I are lifelong residents of Spokane in eastern Washington. We founded and operated a technology business headquartered in Spokane for 28 years. We grew to have offices in Seattle, Boise, Helena, and Bozeman before retiring last spring. Owning and operating a business is challenging, and it demands the ability to accept and adapt to change. Change and challenge are inevitable in any business, and livestock production is no different. They are private businesses, and it is beyond reason for Washington taxpayers to shoulder the expense of hundreds of thousands of dollars to bail them out because they refuse to adapt to meet new challenges as they present themselves. Beginning with the slaughter of the wedge pack in 2012, the state has killed 19 state endangered wolves, nearly 16% of the state's current population of 121. And by the way, I think all of those were on public lands where their depredations took place. 15 of these 19 kills have been done at the behest of one ranching operation that is openly hostile to wolf recovery and refuses to work to eliminate predations through non-lethal means. Now the state is once again rescuing this rancher from his own malfeasance, ordering lethal removal of the OPT pack. It is obvious the terrain being grazed is inappropriate, and non-lethal deterrent of rage riding is ineffective due to this fact. On Monday, the Capitol Press said Len McIrvin of the Diamond M Ranch estimated wolves have killed 30 to 40 calves so far, and that losses will total 70 to 80 calves by the time the herd is off the allotment. My question is, why in the world is this herd still on this allotment? A 2017 poll by Defenders of Wildlife showed that more than 70% of the Washington taxpayers want gray wolf recovery to continue and who see the profound value of these apex predators as resource to all Washington and its citizens. Beyond this insanity of repeatedly doing the same thing and expecting a different result, in deference to the great majority of Washingtonians who want wolves fully recovered and who work to pay taxes in this state, it is time for WDFW to realign policy to meet the needs of the majority of people in this state. As frustrated as private livestock producers are with cattle loss, there are far more Washington citizens just as frustrated with their inability to adapt husbandry techniques to minimize conflict with a colonizing predator. Thank you.
Thank you, Ronald.
I listened to this man speak, and you spoke at the
Wagon. Yeah, in Spokane. And I just have to take some issue with some of the things you're saying.
Let's do it.
And there again, our part of the world, all the wolf depredations have been on private property. You speak to being a business person.
Mm-hmm.
And
28 years, yeah.
Okay, that's cool.
Change happens.
If somebody kept breaking into your business every night and you called law enforcement and they did nothing, would you be happy with the deal?
Well, we got broken into a few times and law enforcement essentially did nothing. They came and got a report and that was it. So The insurance took care of the losses, and
we I don't have insurance for that.
And we got a better security system.
Well, I could too.
I'm telling you what it is, okay?
And I'm not going to throw the guys on public ground underneath the bus. They have a valid contract with.
All right.
I know, okay, but I'm just saying. Yeah, we'll let it go.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mark Riviere. That's rough. And hi, Lorna.
Hi, Brad. Good morning, commissioners. I think most of you know me. I'm Lorna Smith, Executive Director of Western Wildlife Outreach. And I'm going to try to keep my comments very brief. I sent a letter, I believe it was last week, to the commission and the director. Hopefully some of you have had a chance to read that. My organization in 2014 was contracted by the department to prepare a document, and that was a literature review of non-lethal methods, and we looked at over 100 studies. We annotated 50 studies and came up with some recommendations for Washington State on non-lethal methods we thought would be appropriate to use in the state. And I'm glad to say that that report is published in three different places on Department of Fish and Wildlife's website and is pointed to as a place to find information on non-lethal methods. I have to say that non-lethal methods are only going to work when they're suited to the terrain and the operation. And every study we looked at talking about them, that was the number one thing mentioned. And I'm very familiar with the landscape and the terrain in the area we're talking about, where Diamond M Ranch has its allotments. It's very steep, very rugged, very forested terrain, and yet one of the techniques that they are using, range riding, just cannot be correctly done there. And I'm just going to read you very briefly. Effective range riding means keeping the livestock grouped together for protection, providing a regular human presence around the herd to deter the wolves, watching for signs of agitation that signal the presence of predators, and moving the livestock away from predators into safer areas. Certainly, the producer, in order to do that, would need to know where the cattle are at all times to offer that kind of protection. And in the terrain up there in the Colville National Forest on these allotments, I defy anyone to take a look and say they think that can work. So this now is being repeated over and over again. I think we're just headed for more of the same. The Forest Service is certainly co-managers, at the very least, with the department on the wildlife resources up there and on these grazing allotments. There's got to be a meeting of the minds on this and figure out a way to avoid it, because I was in the Wildlife Committee meeting this morning and I heard mentioned that this maybe is a short-term deterrent or a short-term relief to the owner of the cattle and on the grazing allotments. However, the price that the department has to pay to remove even one wolf. So, 3 minutes goes fast. So I'll leave it at that, but most of my information I wanted to convey to you is in that letter from last week. Thank you.
Thank you, Lorna.
Can I just make an observation? The land manager is the National Forest Service. We are not, the department does not co-manage.
No, the wildlife. Yeah. We do co-manage wildlife. Yeah.
And Kiera and Mark.
Chair Smith, Director Sesswine, and members of the Fish and Wildlife Commission, I'd like to return to the issue of the minimum size limit for Chinook in Area 13 in South Puget Sound. I'm a longtime resident of Washington, currently live in Grapeview up in Mason County, and have pursued Chinook all over this state in saltwater for many, many years. And we appreciate the efforts of the department to make a special case in Area 13 for harvesting Chinook. They allow two rods down there, so allows an individual to double their effort in pursuing these fish, although these fish are notoriously hard to catch down there, except in the months of July, August and September, when there's two distinct groups of Chinook that reside in South Puget Sound. Well, one is a resident, that is the blackmouth or the immature Chinook that are there and available year-round, and the other are the migratory Chinook, the fish that are returning to the hatchery systems in South Puget Sound that are distinctly different. These fish are not resident. They could be, but in generally, they're moving in from the north, from areas 11 and other areas in Puget Sound, and they are maturing fish. And due to many factors, some that were discussed earlier in the testimony, and yes, Brad is my fishing partner.
Not this one.
They are
available.
Brad Caldwell, right? The minimum size of Chinook in general in the ocean and in a lot of the sport fisheries is decreasing in recent times for a variety of reasons. Most of them seem to point to ocean conditions. But it seems like a waste to us sports fishermen that these fish that are 18 to 22 inches that are maturing aren't available to be harvested, because ultimately we have to either release them, they die from an incidental mortality when we hook them, or they return to the hatchery where they're going to become surplus fish in most cases. So I would just urge the department, the commission, to urge staff in the department to work with sports fishermen to make an exception in Area 13, not asking for a statewide marine decrease in the minimum size limit, but specifically for Area 13, that during the months of July, August, and September, the minimum size be decreased to about 18 inches. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So with regard to whether or not these smaller fish are jacks or immature feeders that are not destined to mature, fading skin color is one indication. I wondered if...
Three minutes goes fast.
We may be slow learners, but we're...
Thank you for your consideration. No, the other way to look at it is when you clean a fish and you look inside, what do you see with regard to mature or immature? So in your experience and with your fishing partner, when you look at the 22-inch fish as opposed to the 26-inch fish as a surrogate for the smaller ones, which is the size proposal that you're making, what do you see with regard to male and female, and what do you see with regard to small or large gonads?
So the fish that are in the 18 to 22-inch range that we land, of course, we have to release. So all we can do is look at them externally, and we're just judging them based on their external morphological sexual characteristics. So whether the belly's slightly distended, whether there's a kype, and certainly skin color. What is obvious are the blackmouth in South Puget Sound. They're a very different fish from these maturing fish. So they're, we catch them in the same size range, but what I'm maintaining is that the maturing fish destined for the hatcheries, are distinct.
So my question is, if you use the 22-inchers that you can keep, the borderline fish that you can keep, and you clean those fish, what do you see inside? And I guess the question here is, I think your fishing partner said most of the fish... Or maybe he said there's hardly any of the feeder fish in July, August, September. So my question is, when you look at that inside visual proof of your 22-inch fish, do you see half of them being sexually mature, or 90% or 10% or what?
Most of them are sexually mature. Yeah, most of them are sexually mature. Because we're specifically targeting those mature fish rather than the blackmouth during those months of July, August, and September. So we fish in different areas, we fish in different ways, and so the fish that we do land that are legal are typically mature, yes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Kiara, welcome.
Thanks. My name is Kiara, for those of you that don't know me. I live up in Whatcom County. And I'm addressing you today as a representative of the Endangered Species Coalition, and we represent 380 nonprofit organizations. So you can imagine how many members I'm here today representing. I was planning to come to address the issue of cohabitation with wolves, but yesterday we had a tragedy in the orca whale community, and so I'm going to be addressing that issue. So yesterday I shared a call in the mid-afternoon with a good friend who works for the Center for Whale Research. His name is Ken Balcom, and all three pods, J, K, and L, were gathered right out in front of his research center. And Scarlet, J50, one of the only killer whales to survive the last 3 years of reproduction, 3.5 years old, J50 passed away. So we are looking at 0% successful reproduction in orca whales in the past 4 years. And J50 died of starvation, lack of Chinook salmon, too much underwater noise, and bioaccumulants. So those are the three factors. When scientists do modeling for killer whale health, killer whale population health, those are the three factors that they factor in. Things like oil spills would be factored into the bioaccumulants, right? Toxins. So I'm here to address a couple things. The first is the need to fiercely protect our shorelines. We're herring, the foraging fish that Chinook salmon feed on, the primary, almost sole food source of the orca whales, are Chinook salmon. So we have to protect our shorelines, and we need to be strict in that enforcement. And contractors that are violating permitting processes, need to have repercussions that are serious enough that they will not violate those permitting processes. So that's the first thing that I want to say. And then the second thing is hatcheries aren't producing fish without bioaccumulants. So hatchery fish have bioaccumulants in them that cause increase in toxicity of orca whale blubber. And that's one of the things that, so we need to prioritize wild fish recovery and prioritize conservation hatcheries, not production hatcheries. So hatcheries are not a long-term solution because of genetic degradation. So hatcheries cause smaller and smaller fish, and that is known, and that is scientific, and that's something that should be factored in. So ocean conditions, yes, there aren't enough foraging fish, but I would just like for you to consider that. And then also really quick, 50% of the fish that the orcas depend on for survival comes from the Columbia River. So we need to return the Chinook on the Columbia. Thank you.
Wait, Mr. Baker.
I think we're all familiar with the need to assist with fish in the Columbia and environs and in the Puget Sound. My question is what about the ocean? Are these orca coming to us, happy and healthy, and then becoming emaciated here, or do we all have similar problems out in the ocean?
Yeah, so the orca whales feed off of Chinook salmon from Northern California to Southeast Alaska. So their range for feeding is a very large range. And the best available science says that we need to increase our fisheries, our available Chinook by 20%, and that would stabilize their populations. That's science out of Rain Coast Conservation, and I can send that study to y'all. But in terms of the southern residents, their 50% that comes from the Columbia, that's their first, that's the kind of their first feed. So that's where they accumulate their blubber, and they're coming into the Puget Sound from the Columbia without enough blubber. So they're coming here starving, and then there's not enough available Chinook here. So really, I would say the Columbia is 50%. That is ocean Chinook. Those Chinook that are in the ocean are coming from the Columbia River, and that's where we need to focus our energy. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Kira. Good to see you. That brings the end to open public input. Thank you all. Very enlightening and good emotional input. That's good.